Welcome to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. You can subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association and HCP Live homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. For those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Today's discussion will be on the topic of intercepting lung cancer. Whereas right now, it is said that about 90% of the emphasis is on treatment of cancer, it's felt that the emphasis will ultimately be on prevention as well as treatment of those cases that sneak through. There's a common perception that cancer risk reduction or prevention is passive, such as not smoking or avoiding other inhaled carcinogens. But cancer interception is the active way of combating cancer and carcinogenesis at earlier and earlier stages. The cancer biology behind cancer interception is increasingly solid. This was published in an article over 10 years ago in 2011 by Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, who won the 2009 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. We were fortunate to have her as part of the early review team for the research that we're going to talk about today. We are speaking with the principal investigators of our lung cancer interception team. This multi-year research project was initially funded by the American Lung Association, Stand Up to Cancer, and Longevity. And based on the initial findings, this project has been extended another 3 years with support from Longevity and the American Lung Association. Today we have Dr. Dubinette, who is the Dean of the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and Associate Vice Chancellor for Research. He's a distinguished professor in the UCLA Department of Medicine, Pathology, and Pharmacology, and founding director of the UCLA Clinical and Translational Science Institute. Building on original discoveries relevant to inflammation and immunity in lung cancer, he developed a translational research program which utilizes these laboratory-based discoveries in the translational and clinical environment. We also have Dr. Spira, who's a professor of medicine, bioinformatics, and pathology at Boston University. He has built a translational research program that focuses on genomic alterations associated with lung disease, leading to a molecular test for the early detection of lung cancer. In addition, he is the global head of interventional oncology at Johnson & Johnson, where he leads a research and development team developing novel approaches for locally delivering therapies directly into lung tumors. Thank you both for being here and welcome.
Thank you, Al. Great to be back. We're very, very excited to update you on the progress we've made and, more importantly, tell you about the next wave of research that American Lung Association Longevity are funding, which we believe will bring our discoveries closer to the clinic to intercept lung cancer and those at risk. So thank you.
So just a few background notes here. Lung cancer, as we know, is the leading cause of cancer death in the United States and worldwide. And this remains the case despite the initiation of low-dose CT scan screening in an at-risk population both here and worldwide. The rate of uptake of that screening opportunity, however, remains disappointingly low despite the publication of multiple studies showing its effectiveness and the efforts of lung cancer advocacy groups like the American Lung Association to educate the at-risk population to get screened. Lung cancer also remains a leading cause of death in the U.S. and worldwide, also despite the great strides in both mutation-targeted therapy and immunotherapy over the last 10 years. Therefore, lung cancer remains a leading cause of cancer death in large part because we're unable to detect it early enough or to intervene on its trajectory or possibly to identify it before it becomes a cancerous lesion. In other words, intercept it. We last spoke with both Dr. Spira and Dr. Dubinette on a Lungcast episode number 4 back in November of 2020. Now, almost 4 years later, please summarize, if you could, the results of the first phase of your research that involved establishing a precancer genome atlas and the identification of molecular and imaging markers to help distinguish between a benign versus malignant nodule, and also the markers that may help in precision interception of cells in clinical trials.
Yeah, thank you, Al. And again, excited to be back and talk about the progress. What I'll do maybe is kick it off in terms of talking about what we've done over the last 4 years, focusing in on the precancer atlas for squamous cell lung cancer, one of the two subtypes of lung cancer that we went after. And then I'll hand it over to Dr. Dubinet to tackle the adenocarcinoma precancer atlas, the commonest form of lung cancer. In addition, I can then come back and talk about the second and third aims of our proposal, which were to develop early diagnostic biomarkers for lung cancer, as well as predictive biomarkers of response to neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy. But let me begin with the precancer atlas, since that was really a focus of what we did over the last 4 years and certainly of what we're going to do in the next 3 years. So just to back up for a moment, the idea here was to create a molecular atlas, literally a map of all the cellular molecular changes that occur as a pre-malignant lesion in the airway or lung progresses towards lung cancer or regresses away from lung cancer. If we had such a map, we could then develop biomarkers that could predict which individuals with precancerous lesions in their airway or lung are destined to go on and become invasive lung cancer, and that's the group we want to intervene upon. In addition, we develop novel targets for that intervention. Understanding the biology would give us novel targets to go after to block the process and prevent lung cancer from recurring in those individuals. So that was the overarching goal. One of, I think, the major accomplishments, quite frankly, in the last 4 years was simply putting together the coalition of the willing, I'll call it, investigators across multiple medical centers in the United States and in Europe who could find patients that have these precancerous lesions in their airway and lung and collect them very carefully for the molecular studies. This is not trivial to do. And I'm incredibly proud of the foundation that we established, sharing protocols, sharing samples, and sharing data across many, many medical centers. I think 4 years ago, we talked about this as our major challenge. We were able to overcome that challenge and work together under one umbrella. Again, these are groups that normally compete with each other, actually working together as a single team. So I'm very, very proud of that progress. With that progress, we actually were able to collect samples from more than 400 patients that had premalignant lesions in their airway and lung. To our knowledge, the largest cohort in the world of individuals with premalignant lesions for lung cancer that have samples collected from molecular studies. Let me start with the squamous cell studies, and I'll hand it over to Steve for the adenocarcinoma. On the squamous side, it was a very unique study that we did where we took patients from two cohorts, one in the UK with Dr. Sam James at the University College of London, and a second with Dr. Mary Reed at Roswell Park Cancer Institute here in the US in Buffalo, New York. They both were following high-risk smokers who had premalignant lesions, premalignant squamous carcinoma lesions in their central airways found on bronchoscopy. These lesions were sampled longitudinally as the lesion progressed towards cancer or regressed away, because these lesions were accessible in their central airway via bronchoscopy. So what that allowed us to do is sort of the natural history study and see what are the molecular changes that occur as a lesion progresses towards cancer or regresses away. And we developed some very significant insights that I'll share at a high level. Number one, we found that the immune microenvironment of these premalignant squamous lesions was a determinant as to whether the lesion would progress on to invasive lung cancer. Specifically, we found that an immunosuppressive microenvironment around the precancerous lesion was associated with that lesion progressing on to invasive cancer. In other words, not having the appropriate immune response was a problem. And that was potentially a predictor of the bad actors, of those lesions that were going to progress. We then, using some very careful molecular tools like single cell sequencing, were able to drill down at a higher resolution and identify the various immune cell types that were lacking in that microenvironment and the changes in the epithelial component, the premalignant component that were driving or associated with that immune suppressive microenvironment. So what this allows us to do ultimately is identify both biomarkers in the immune microenvironment that can tell us whether a precancerous lesion in the airway is going to progress to cancer, and then novel targets that we could go after to block that process, to block that immunosuppressive process. So significant progress on that front. Steve, let me hand it over to you for the adenocarcinoma side.
Yes, I'll begin by thanking you, Dr. Rizzo, for ALA support and in the work that's really facilitated this. So we developed a really greater understanding of the molecular, cellular, and immunologic changes during early stages of lung adenocarcinoma development, and with the goal of improving diagnostic and therapeutic approaches for patients with pulmonary lesions that are at risk to become lung cancer. And so really what we're doing here is looking to elucidate the immunopathogenesis of early tumorigenesis. So we evaluated surgical resection specimens in which we had invasive disease, but also found that we had premalignancy in the same lobe. And also did studies looking at subsolid and solid nodules that represent the spectrum of early lung adenocarcinoma and are the lesions that pulmonologists and thoracic surgeons spend their time concerned about. So together with normal lung tissue, we were able to do single cell RNA sequencing and validate these results by flow cytometry, multiplex immunofluorescence techniques that allow us to look at both single cells, their gene expression, their protein, and then their relationship within the tissue. And what we found is very much analogous to what Dr. Spira described in squamous cell carcinoma, in that there were significant decreases in gene expression associated with cytolytic activities of tumor-infiltrating natural killer cells and what we call natural killer T cells. These are the cells that recognize abnormalities even in the absence of MHC. So they're really a frontline defense, and they begin to fall as lung adenocarcinoma develops. This is accompanied by a marked reduction in the effector T cells that are specific for tumor antigens, and an increase in what we call T regulatory cells or CD4 cells that suppress the immune response as we move from normal to subsolid to solid nodules. So our findings strongly suggest that there's a suppression of immune surveillance across the entire spectrum of early stage lung adenocarcinoma. In addition to that, the environment of these developing cancers were found to have gene expression analysis that indicated that the cancer-associated alveolar type 2 cells and the fibroblasts can contribute to this deregulation of the extracellular matrix, potentially affecting and limiting the immune infiltration in subsolid nodules through these interactions in the microenvironment. So together, we have built really an atlas at the beginning of lung adenocarcinoma and look forward to extending this, as we'll explain in a moment.
And then, Al, if I can go on to AIMS 2 and 3. For AIM 2, as you recall, our goal there was another very important question of how to distinguish benign from malignant pulmonary nodules that we are increasingly finding on imaging of the chest. As you know, we're beginning now to screen as a routine for lung cancer in high-risk individuals. Adoption is lagging, but we are beginning to see more and more of it happening. And we're also finding these nodules incidentally on individuals that have CT scans done for other reasons. There are more than a million of these nodules found every year here in the United States. The vast majority of them are not malignant. And so this is the proverbial needle in the haystack. How do we find the subset of nodules that represent early stage lung cancer where we can resect it for cure? And so what we've been doing within our original funding is developing cohorts, large cohorts, hundreds of patients that have pulmonary nodules found on imaging, either screening or incidentally found, where we are collecting on those individuals blood samples, nasal swabs, and the image, the original CT image on which the nodule was found, and then following those individuals over time to see which of those nodules turned out to be malignant and which did not. And then developing molecular and imaging-based biomarkers to predict which nodules represent malignancy and which don't. And at a very high level, what we've been able to develop is a gene expression-based signature in nasal epithelial cells that can predict whether a nodule deep in your lung is benign or malignant. And that is the biomarker that is making its way with an industry partner into the clinic as a commercial test. In addition, we were integrating that biomarker with imaging-based features, so so-called radiomics, AI and machine learning algorithms that look at the CT image itself and extract features on that image that are associated with cancer status. And in addition, we add layered on a third biomarker in the same population, which is a blood-based test looking at circulating DNA from the tumor. And this was done with Victor Velculescu's group at Hopkins. It's actually a unique assay, a liquid biopsy assay that looks at something called fragmentomics, the big word, but that just means the size of those DNA fragments in the blood as a predictor as to whether that nodule on the CT scan is benign or malignant. And I think one of the most exciting pieces of this is having all three layers, the molecular test in the nose, the imaging-based radiomics, and a blood-based test all in the same patients, so we can integrate them together, a multimodal test, if you wish, Al, that we think is ultimately the path forward for these nodule patients. Lastly, our third aim was to go into folks that were getting neoadjuvant or adjuvant therapy with early-stage lung cancer. And this area, as you know, Al, is exploding over the last 4 years. In fact, now it has become standard of care for patients with early-stage lung cancer who are undergoing surgery to also receive neoadjuvant, either chemotherapy or chemotherapy and immunotherapy. And that actually reduces recurrence after surgery, which is a major issue for early-stage lung cancer patients. And what we've been doing is partnering with Julie Brammer and Patrick Ford at Johns Hopkins, who have large clinical trials in this space. And we are developing predictive biomarkers to figure out who would actually benefit from the neoadjuvant immunotherapy in that setting. In addition, we're partnering with Charlie Swanton's group in the UK, developing personalized circulating tumor DNA biomarkers that predict after surgery whether you're at high risk for recurrence, and then using that to enrich that population in adjuvant studies of various drugs that are given after surgery to prevent recurrence. So significant progress made on that front as well.
I must say that having been able to hear your research from the beginning a number of years ago, it is certainly falling into place and making a lot of sense. Just a couple of questions. The extension of your research, I think you've covered that already as to what you plan on doing going forward. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I think going forward, I can talk about the first aim and then we hand it over to Steve to talk about the second aim. They're really built off of this foundation that we've
Right.
established over the past 4 or 5 years with our Lung Cancer Interception Dream Team. So specifically, what we're going to do, though, is really augment the Precancer Atlas portion of the first wave of research. And by that, what I mean is one of the ways we've had real success in the lung squamous carcinoma space is by having longitudinal samples collected over time because they're accessible in the central airway. Premalignant adenocarcinoma lesions, the research that Steve has been leading and beautifully doing, is more limited, as he says, because we're dealing with cross-sectional sampling. The pre-invasive disease is very deep in the lung parenchyma and not accessible with conventional bronchoscopy in the airway. However, in the last 3 to 4 years, there's been the emergence of robot-assisted bronchoscopy that allows a pulmonologist to go much further in via the airway and actually sample very small peripheral lesions in the lung endoscopically. So what that is allowing us to do is put a proposal forward in our first aim to actually go out and follow a cohort of individuals that have ground glass opacities found on their imaging of the chest. These are so-called hazy opacities, often found on CT screening for lung cancer, that very frequently represent either minimally invasive or premalignant adenocarcinoma of the lung. What we can now do is go out with this robotic bronchoscopy procedure, sample that lesion, and in a subset of folks, follow that over time, repeat that procedure 6 to 12 months later, and actually find the molecular alterations happening within the lesion itself as it either progresses towards cancer or regresses away. And that's a major step forward in building a temporal atlas for adenocarcinoma of the lung, a premalignant atlas. I know, Steve, if you want to talk a little more about aim two.
Yes, I think what we're really doing in this next aim is expanding our profile to even be more sophisticated by including spatial and epigenetic profiling of these premalignant lesions. And so one of the advantages we have is as we've been doing this work in the first phase of the funding, the technologies have proliferated and become entirely powerful. So now we can look at spatial profiling, for example, using what's called imaging mass cytometry and as well spatial transcriptomics. This allows us to uncover the tissue architecture of these molecular processes associated with progression, which in turn help us to delineate specifically cell-cell interactions underlying these events. So as Avi has pointed out, we have this opportunity to look not just at a single point in time, but events over time, and then apply these techniques. So for example, epigenetic profiling will allow us to overlay this information together with the gene expression, and we have what we call a multi-omic layer of data to better understand the regulation of the processes that are associated with progression. So expanding the precancer atlas in this way helps provide a deeper understanding of lung cancer development and lead to the advances in real lung cancer interception. We'll understand the process of the disease, and because we'll be evaluating many patients, we'll understand the heterogeneity of disease and be able to treat patients and treat risk in a much more accurate way than we've ever had to before.
The fact that we're now able to sample with robot-assisted bronchoscopy these lesions over time really sets a foundation or a proof of concept that we ultimately can use that same approach to deliver a therapy directly into those lesions to prevent those at high risk from progressing on to invasive adenocarcinoma. And I think that's an exciting foundation, or really springboard, to future interception clinical trials in this high-risk population.
Right. Now, you made that clear when you were presenting this data in the first place, which was very exciting to the Lung Association and Longevity both. What is the rough timeline for when you think this will actually be able to be in patient trials?
Yeah, it's a really good question and always a hard one to answer. Right. I'll give you my guesstimate and then curious to get Steve's thoughts. I think we're still at a relatively early stage, right? We're still developing the early discovery-based cohorts and understanding, especially for adenocarcinoma lung, what are those driver events that Steve described that potentially are targetable. I think at the end of this period of research, hopefully we can then take some of those hypotheses and begin to test them, initially in vitro and in vivo preclinical models. So taking some of these targets, developing drugs or other approaches that can reverse the process and seeing that they do have efficacy and lack toxicity in preclinical models. And then ultimately we'd be ready to go into first in human clinical trials. So I think we're still a few years out, to say the least. But I think this again sets the foundation. Having the understanding allows us to do this in a precise way, as Steve said, and potentially a relatively non-invasive way to directly deliver with the robot-assisted bronchoscopy.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're several years off, but things are developing in the right direction. And one example of that is we're working together with the engineers at UCLA and our colleagues at MIT in evaluating algorithms that predict the risk of lung cancer. And that is to take a single screening CT scan and be able to say, this patient is at risk for lung cancer development in the next year, no matter what the CT scan shows, and with a high performance characteristic out to 6 years, which means we'll have a time measured in years with patients who may be at extraordinary risk, and be able to look at nasal gene expression, be able to look at markers in the peripheral blood to define in a large population of individuals being screened what the underlying biology is of risk. And being able to know that accurately, we'll be able to treat that risk. So I think this is advancing in the right direction very rapidly. We'll be able to utilize the information that we've been able to gather and we're gathering now on the details of the immunopathogenesis of the disease and be ready to treat patients depending upon the nature of their risk. And so there's been a lot of new information in terms of pollution causing as a causal agent in addition to smoking. And all of these environmental risks can lead to a different pathway to get to malignancy. So here we are going by what a patient's family said to me once is that they know the best type of lung cancer to have. And when I asked the question, what is that? They said, it's the lung cancer you never get.
That's right.
So we're on the verge of that scenario.
Right. You touched on something that I wanted to have a question that I wanted to go further on with regard to the environment of the lung itself. And, you know, for many years, certainly when I was in medical school, the feeling was that the lung was a sterile environment. But with all the new technology and being able to sample things in the lung more peripherally, we know there's a microbial community in the lung and there's a microbiome in the respiratory surface. And between coughing, pulmonary macrophages, respiratory cilia, that microbiome plays a role in the environment you were talking about related to the immune response, the innate and the adaptive immune mechanism. So I think you're right in where I think it's going to go as far as what's pro-inflammatory versus anti-inflammatory, what's pro-tumorigenic versus anti-tumorigenic. And it sounds like you're coming up with some answers, both from a cellular as well as cytokine type of visualization of what's happening in the airways. Any perspective on that? And exactly, what am I interpreting your research right?
Yes, I think that there are fascinating studies that have been coming out about the potential to examine the microbiome in the lung. And one of the things that's apparent is that we do have a very large population of microorganisms in the upper airway, and at times those populate the lower airway, leading, if that balance called dysbiosis gets exaggerated, to an inflammatory process that has been associated with the immunopathogenesis of lung cancer. And there are a couple of fascinating studies that link this together, both in laboratory model systems, but also in individuals, such that if one has this dysbiosis, it appears that patients more readily develop lung cancer and do worse with their disease. Why is that? We think that the cytokines developed in that process of dysbiosis are very much related to the cytokines we've been studying that lead to malignancy and lead the immune system away from recognition of tumor antigens. So, for example, the generation of IL-17 is a cytokine that's been known to occur when we have the microbiota imbalanced. IL-17 both comes from stimulation with IL-1 beta and promotes IL-1 beta. So those are cytokines that protect epithelial cells from cell death. They cause characteristics downstream that cause dysregulation of the epithelium, cause cells to undergo this process of epithelium mesenchymal transition and transformation. So cells can become normal epithelium to cancer cells with the ability to move. So all of the things that we would like to avoid happen in those instances. So there will be a lot more work required to link up this imbalance of the microbiota with those risk factors. But we see many of the same pathways that lead us down the pathway toward cancer, and may be particularly important in those patients who are at risk either from smoking or from their underlying genetic abnormalities in their epithelium, or as we've learned recently, from certain forms of air pollution.
Right. And Al, let me add that while we're not directly studying the microbiome in our current wave of funding, we are collecting samples that will be stored from this very large cohort, very unique cohort, that then in a future date can be used with the latest sequencing techniques to study the microbiome. So I think it's one of the real valuable assets that's being created here by the funding from Longevity and the American Lung Association is really a foundational set of samples and cohorts that we then can further interrogate and look at areas like the microbiome and their association with lung carcinogenesis.
I wanted to go back to the biomarker you mentioned, the blood biomarker. There seems to be a lot of that going on in the industry these days. And you mentioned fragmentomics, and I know there's proteomics and people looking at cell-free DNA and epigenetics. What's your feeling about the fragmentomics? Is that a unique thing you're looking at compared to some of the other things that are being evaluated?
Yeah, it's a great question, Al. And I do think the approach we took within our first round of funding was unique. There is an explosion of tools in peripheral blood samples that are being looked at for cell-free DNA, circulating tumor cells, proteomics, microRNA, gene expression. I mean, there's a laundry list of things that folks are interrogating, all of which have some biological rationale. I think the fragmentomics approach is unique. Instead of looking for a specific pattern of mutation that may be very difficult to find in a very small concentration of circulating tumor DNA, what Dr. Valkalescu's group at Hopkins has pioneered is an approach to look at the fragment size, the size of that circulating tumor DNA. And what they have found is that for biological reasons, tumor cells fragment their DNA differently when they die and turn over. And so the size of those fragments that spill over into the bloodstream are different. And that's becomes a very sensitive and specific biomarker that they have developed across a number of cancer types, not just for lung cancer. So we were really excited to take the biospecimens and the cohorts from our study and partner with Victor to take a look at fragmentomics in these patients. And we're very excited by the data that we generated so far with that group in the space.
Well, I want to thank you both for your time today, especially for this exciting work you're doing to intercept lung cancer. So for listeners who want to hear more about lung cancer in general, we are developing a great archive of discussions on our show feeds, including episode number 16 on lung cancer low-dose CT screening that we talked about with Dr. James Mulshine, episode 34 with a medical oncologist, Dr. Carolyn Presley, and episode 41 with a thoracic surgeon, Dr. Jonathan Spicer, talking about the evolving landscape of lung cancer treatment. Be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. I want to thank Dr. Dubinette and Dr. Spiram again for their time today. And please keep in mind that aside from these educational endeavors on the podcast, the American Lung Association, through its Research Institute, is a source of funding for researchers in all aspects of lung disease. And for more information on this, you can go to lung.org/research. And until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.